Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We have one of the region's finest chefs in the studio with us today. He'll answer your questions about food and fine dining. Rob Handel of the Bee's Knees Cafe at Heather Ridge Farm in Preston Hollow is here. Rob has been cooking since he was a kid, when his grandmother first set him to cracking eggs and peeling potatoes in her resort kitchen. Since then, he has broadened his culinary horizons a bit, even studied a little biology and chemistry along the way, and now he's the ruler of the kitchen over at the Bee's Knees Cafe. There, he crafts both classic dishes and unique preparations, pairing the meat and poultry raised on the farm with local produce, cheeses, dairy, and foraged goods. So let's get to know Chef Handel. Give us a call. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can get in touch with us online. Check in on Facebook at facebook.com/WAMC Radio. Tweet us at WAMC Vox Pop, or you can email us voxpop@WAMC.org. But again, the number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Well, Rob, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ray.
Now, you know how the show works, right? Have you heard it?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm a frequent listener.
So you and I will chat a bit. We'll take some calls. We'll eat some food. And I see that you brought food. Jessica's here taking a picture of it. You going to tweet that?
Put it on Facebook.
Okay, so if you want to see the food that we'll be trying here in a little bit, go to our Facebook, WAMC Radio. So what caught me in the introduction that Jessica wrote for me, and I occasionally pre-read so I don't sound like a buffoon, even though I usually do anyway, is the poultry and the meat raised on the farm. So all the meat and poultry that you serve is raised right there?
Yeah, exactly. So primarily, we're a livestock farm. We raise a variety of meat and poultry.
So it's a working farm.
Yeah. It's a working farm, and the cafe is right in the center of the farm.
Wow.
So after lunch or before lunch, you can walk around. You can see the animals. They're out in the fields. And the farm is working all throughout the week. We do farm tours every week.
Yeah.
Throughout the summer, we do farm tours every week. So
the pork that you guys serve, it's a little different. The pigs can you have such a thing as heritage pigs?
Yeah, and we do actually. So we raise three different varieties of heritage pigs. And the difference between the pigs that we raise and the pigs that you could find commonly in the grocery store is that the modern pork has been bred for very specific characteristics. And none of those characteristics have to do with good taste.
Ah.
They're bred for high yield. They're bred to grow fast. And they're bred to have very little fat and light-colored meat. And that means that they don't have a whole lot of flavor.
Oh.
So our pigs are, the breeds are a lot older. They're traditional breeds that were raised across Europe and the Americas. And they're bred to have more marbling, so more fat in the meat that gives it more flavor. They do better out on pasture, foraging for different plants and weeds and nuts and berries and things of that nature. And it's a totally different animal than what you find in the grocery store.
It tastes better.
Yeah.
The fat helps?
The fat helps a lot. So the fat really carries the flavor in the pork, and it provides a lot of moisture.
Mm.
So people who are used to eating these dry, sawdusty pork chops, part of that has to do with the fact that the factory-raised pork is deficient in fat. It doesn't have enough fat.
Well, let's see. Now, you have an impressive platter here. What did you bring us today?
So I brought a little charcuterie platter today. Some of these are things that we make on the farm. One of it is something that we aren't making yet but are working on. So the first thing is a pork roulette, and that's a pork spread that's made by slowly cooking the pork in some pork fat and then blending it into a spread.
Oh, what else is in it?
There's some different spices in it, some herbs. The pork gets salted and coated with herbs for a couple of days before you cook it. And then also I brought some salami, and this is something that we're not serving at the farm yet. I'm working on developing it at home, but I made this one with venison and pork. It's a mixture of
really?
The two. Yeah. The pork is really important because the pork fat cures very differently than other fats do. So the best salamis and dried sausages are made with the pork fat. And this is a German style of salami. The term salami doesn't refer to a specific sausage. It refers to a whole range of dry-cured sausages.
Mm-hmm.
So this one's called Landjäger, and it's a cold-smoked venison and pork salami.
Mm.
And then along with that are some accompaniments to the charcuterie. There's some pickled cherries. The cherries are from Skamaskat Orchard in Kinderhook. There is some mustard that I made with mustard seeds that that I foraged. They're garlic mustard seeds. So garlic mustard is an invasive plant, and by harvesting the seeds, you're able to stop it from spreading. And then there's also some fennel mostarda, which is an Italian way of preserving fruits or vegetables where it's cooked with mustard and some sweetener to make a sweet and tart kind of preserve.
Interesting. So you're a forager?
Yes, I am.
You like that?
Yeah.
Is it an addiction? Because the people I've had on who are foragers are very into foraging.
Yeah, you know, it really is a bit of an addiction because it's a very unique feeling to be able to go out into the woods and find something that you can eat.
And not die.
And not die.
Yeah.
And realize that there's so much food out there that isn't being utilized.
Well, so good. I look forward to trying all this. Of course, the key to me getting to eat is taking calls. Let's take a call now at 1-800-348-2551. Brian in Saratoga Springs. Brian, you're up.
Thank you. My question is, where would you go as a regular consumer to go out and really find some fine meats and seafoods outside of the regular grocery stores and things like that? I heard you mention the farm and stuff like that. But for regular week-to-week grocery shopping and stuff like that, where are some great places to get some really fine meat?
Well, you know, it's becoming easier to find quality meat as the concept of grass-fed meat, the concept of local, becomes more common. There's several sources online. There's a woman named Jo Robinson. She has a website. I'm forgetting the name of it now. It's called...
we'll find it.
Yeah, we'll find it. But it's a great resource for being able to find, you type in your zip code, and it lists a whole list of places that you can find locally raised grass-fed meat and pastured meats.
And what about seafood? Seafood seems to be something in particular that's difficult to get, other than like someone from a restaurant getting it shipped in and stuff like that.
Yes, I don't have a lot of experience with seafood because the only proteins that we serve on the farm are the things that we produce.
Mm.
So I don't serve any seafood because we don't have a good source for local seafood. I know that there are a couple of fish markets in Albany, but I don't have a lot of experience with them.
All right, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian. We appreciate the call. It's Food Friday, and we are joined today by Chef Rob Handel, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. During that last call, I tried a pickled cherry.
How was it?
Wow. That's good. That's so good. And those are local cherries?
Yeah, those. My daughter and I picked those at Samuscott Orchard in Kinderhook.
Wow. And then so the pickling process for that, the standard pickling process?
Yeah, that's a standard pickling process. I also do lacto-fermented pickles, which is a little bit different. But for the cherries, they were just cooked in vinegar and some spices, a little bit of sugar.
That would be great on a Thanksgiving table.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So you mentioned grass-fed meats, and we've done shows about charcoal and barbecuing and stuff, and there seems to be some sort of there's a split between what tastes better, and some guys really like the grass-fed beef. But what's the difference? How can you tell the difference when you're eating? Is it tougher?
You know, it really depends on how the animal was raised and what the genetics of the animal are. Some people have had bad experiences with grass-fed meat because they're buying from a source that isn't as educated on how to produce good-tasting grass-fed meat.
Yeah.
So, for
is it too lean, though?
I don't find that ours is too lean. Some people say that, but it really depends on how the animal is raised and the genetics of the animal. So we buy cows in the spring and then we finish them for beef, throughout the summer and the fall. And we get them from a farmer who has been doing this for a long time. He has a really well-established line of genetics, and those cows grow better on grass.
Mm.
You know, not every cow, you can't put every cow out in a field and have them grow well on grass. A lot of cows have been bred to respond better to grain.
Mm.
So our cows do really well on the grass, and our management system produces really great beef.
And so as far as preparing it, you don't really have to do anything different?
No, you do have to. There are some differences. So, for instance, there is naturally less fat on grass-fed beef.
Yeah.
So you don't cook it as much as you might cook a commercially raised beef.
Mm.
You always cook it maybe 5 to 10 degrees less than you would cook a commercially raised steak.
Ah, so it's the temperature and not the duration that is key.
Well, the temperature is a factor of the duration, but yeah, it's. I always do everything based on temperature, and I always recommend that people buy a thermometer and use a thermometer whenever you're cooking meat, because it's really a foolproof way to know that you're not overcooking your meat, that your meat won't be tough and dry.
And I have no problem like cooking. If I cook if I marinate a London broil and I cook that, I can do that by feel, by sense.
Mm-hmm.
But when I'm cooking a pork chop or chicken, I have a much more difficult time. My instinct is to go too long and it dries out.
Yeah, and a lot of people do that. And that's one reason why a lot of people don't have an affinity for pork chops, because they're used to their mother's pork chops that were cooked to death. And the reason why people naturally tend to overcook pork is because back in the day there was a fear of trichinosis.
Yeah.
And this is no longer an issue. That was a management issue in the farming at the time. You know, there hasn't been a reported case of trichinosis since the 50s.
Is that because everybody overdoes their pork?
No, it has to do with how the pigs were being fed. There was actually a law passed that you can't feed pigs raw meat, and that's where the trichinosis was being carried.
Ah, very interesting.
So now the recommended temperature for pork is 145 degrees.
Wow.
So if you cook it to 145 degrees, it's safe and it's really succulent and juicy.
So medium well is not out of the question then for pork?
No, not at all.
All right, let's take a break. We're joined today by Chef Rob Handel. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. It's Food Friday. Oh, I think it's almost time to eat.
Support for WAMC comes from Kern Compliance Services Incorporated, Greenwich, New York, and now in St. Paul, Minnesota. National compliance and regulatory consultants for the life insurance industry, KernCompliance.com. Blue Heron Restaurant and Catering, located in the Old Town Hall, Sunderland, Massachusetts. Serving globally inspired, locally sourced cuisine, open for dinner Tuesday through Sunday at 5, BlueHeronDining.com. Harold's Ice Cream, Thorne's Marketplace, downtown Northampton, Massachusetts. Over 300 flavors of handcrafted dairy and dairy-free ice creams, cakes, hot fudge, and more, Harold's.com. And Spirit House, Amherst, Massachusetts, a family-owned wine, beer, and spirits retailer offering organically farmed wines from around the world. Wine tastings, Saturday afternoons, spirithaus.com.
Vox Pop, it's Food Friday. Delicious. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Rob Handel is here of the Bee's Knees Cafe at Heather Ridge Farm in Preston Hollow. And, wow, the pork roulette. Amazing, man. Amazing.
Oh, thank you.
I put it on a cracker. Is that appropriate?
Yeah, that's a cracker is just fine.
You know, I would like, maybe I could get some of this for the Giants game on Sunday. A couple of beers, some of that. That would be really good. All right, phone lines are loading up here. And let's go to Kathy in Greenwich. Kathy, you're on.
Oh, okay. Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to compliment Rob on his genius sort of concept of putting a cafe in the middle of a farm. I think that's really smart.
Okay.
I myself am a vegetarian, but I'm fascinated about this mustard he made from garlic mustard, which I never dared eat any of that plant, and I'm wondering how he got that idea, and, you know, what did you do to make the mustard, Rob?
It's good, too. Just had some.
Sure. So I just have to say, it wasn't my concept to put the cafe on the farm. The woman who owns the farm, my boss, Carol Clement, conceived the cafe, and I took over.
She's not here. You take the credit, man.
She's not here, but it's her concept.
All right.
So the garlic mustard, you know, it's everybody has seen it. Not everybody knows that they've seen it or knows what it is, but it's every place.
Right.
And some people realize that it's a big ecological issue in our area. And I've been eating the garlic mustard as a green for quite a while. And when you read the foraging books, it generally recommends that you eat the tender young leaves as a green. And that's fine, but it was getting a little boring. And I had noticed that, you know, they would go to seed, and the seeds were, I tasted some of the seeds one day, and they tasted great. They tasted just like, you know, commercially prepared mustard seeds. So I decided to collect some and see if they would respond well to be turned into a mustard. And they're actually very easy to collect. If you've seen the plant before, it has these big, long heads. You just wait until they get brown and brittle, shake them into a bucket, and then winnow them like you would do grain. So in front of a fan or on a windy day, you crush up all of the pods and seeds, and then you drop them and let the wind carry away the pods, and the seeds fall down into a bowl. And then you can use them however you would use regular mustard seeds. You know, soak them overnight with some vinegar and either beer, wine, cider, anything of that nature. And then blend them in the morning, you know, blend them with some, I use a little bit of honey in it. It does benefit from some sweetener, some sugar, some salt, and that's it.
Wow, that's cool. You know, the other thing I want to say is I'm fascinated by how people, when they're little, latch on to some little thing. Like you said, your grandmother, you cooked with your grandmother. And, you know, the smallest things affect people. You never know.
We were talking about this before the show started. I said it's amazing how many people who are on this program started cooking in their grandmother's kitchen. It's incredible. It's like once you're in that culture, it's tough to even think about getting out.
Yeah, it really is. And my grandmother did a lot of foraging, so that really sparked my foraging. You know, I would go to her house, and she would have me go outside and pick wild chives and then make eggs and wild chives for breakfast, and that was the start of my foraging career.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's really cool. I try and do lots of things with my little grandson because I'm curious what he's going to, you know, do. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Kathy, have a great weekend. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. It is a Food Friday, and we're here with Chef Rob Handel of Bee's Knees Cafe at Heather Ridge Farm in Preston Hollow. Let's go to Joe in Woodstock. Joe.
Hi, how you doing? I'm not sure if it's something that the chef can speak to or not, but I buy some of my meat from their farm at the Dougherty Farmers Market. And I guess my curiosity is why lamb and goat tend to be so expensive. They seem like they're fairly hands-off animals to raise as far as how they graze. So I just don't know.
Well, they really aren't hands-off to raise. In order to raise lamb and goat, there's a lot of factors that go into it. Especially our lamb and goat, they have to be moved every day while they're being raised. So we practice.
What do you mean?
The way we farm, it's a concept called rotational grazing. So they get put into, we use electric netting to contain them in a certain part of a field, and then they get moved around every single day to a new spot where they get fresh grass and they're eating this fresh grass. So there's a lot of time and labor input. And then you also have to maintain the herd of older sheep and goats in order to perpetuate new lambs and kids every spring.
Oh, interesting.
So there are a lot of inputs that go into it. The processing fees are the same as a beef cow, whereas you get 1,000 pounds of meat from cattle, you only get, you know, 30 or 40 pounds of meat from a lamb or a goat.
Mm.
So there's a lot of factors that play into that.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Because I was just, you know, I know goats like the highest consumed protein in the world. And, you know, I prefer lamb and goat as a red meat to beef based on saturated fats and whatnot. So
You know, a lot of people have a misconception that goats are very easy to raise. But in this part of the world where goats aren't native, there's a lot of issues. You know, you have to be very vigilant about parasites and things like that. So it's not as hands-off as people suspect.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. 1-800-348-2551 if you have a question for Chef Rob Handel. Here's one that came in via email, Rob. It says, I love blood sausages. I learned to make them with my grandmother when I was younger. Do you make any? And can blood be found for them in the Saratoga area?
I love blood sausage, too. I don't make it because, as of right now, the local processors who handle processing the animals aren't able to properly collect and give us the blood.
Ah.
So it has to do with the infrastructure there. I don't know if there's a source for blood in the Saratoga area. I would suggest calling around to several different butchers and asking for it.
So while we were taking that last call, this here, Rob, what is that? It's a pickled something.
Yeah, so that's called fennel mostarda.
Oh, it's so good.
Oh, thank you. So the mostarda, it's an Italian technique of pickling where it gets cooked in a sweetened vinegar solution with mustard. So it's sweet, it's a little spicy from the mustard, it's tangy from the vinegar.
Again, all of this would go really well with the Giants game on Sunday, so I might have to take some notes here. Let's go to Pete in Del Mar. Pete, you're on.
Yes, hello, thanks. Great show.
Thanks.
I wanted to ask about rabbit in particular. I have a long history personally with rabbit, and I raise them, and I would like to get your feedback on what you know about not just preparing and serving it, but also raising them, because the rabbits I have are raised pretty much 100% off of what I feed them out of my garden and basically grazing my own lawn and feeding the rabbits. And I've had good success in a very small space.
Yeah, I have rabbits too right now, and I just started in the summer, so I haven't been able to breed them and have any kits yet. But that's great. I know rabbit, I love to use rabbit. I think it's great that you're raising them from your garden scraps and your lawn. Some of my favorite ways to do rabbit are to braise it like chicken. So, you know, the legs, the front legs, there's not a whole lot on them. So sometimes I sacrifice them just for making stock, for flavoring the stock.
Yeah.
The back legs, they're really great if you brown them and then braise them with some stock, some aromatic vegetables like onions, carrots, celery, coriander and mustard seed, juniper, bay. Things like that go really well with the rabbit meat. You know, as you know, it's a very mild meat, so it goes well with a really wide variety of flavors. And it's something that a lot of people are kind of squeamish to try because they don't like the idea of eating a rabbit. But if you like chicken, you're almost certain to like rabbit. It's a really mild, delicate meat.
I hear it's more popular in Europe.
Yeah, it is. And one of the, as you realize, one of the advantages is that you are able to raise quite a bit of meat in a very small amount of space and in a quick time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, have you ever heard of anybody, I keep them in, I've experimented with various types of hutches, but if I had more room, I would like to try sort of like, you know, the chicken tractors, you know, where you keep the chickens in a cage and then sort of bring them across the pasture.
Yeah, if you're interested in...
Have you ever heard of anybody doing that with rabbits?
Yeah, I have. The name that you'd want to Google to find out more about that is Daniel Salatin, S-A-L-A-T-I-N. His father is Joel Salatin. They have a farm in Virginia, and he's...
I've heard that name.
Yeah,
sure.
So if you Google Polyface Farm or Daniel Salatin, he has a ton of information about raising rabbits in a tractor.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
And one more thing I want to say. I'm from Greenville originally... And you're right nearby.
Yeah, we're about 15 minutes from Greenville.
Terrific. Thanks a lot.
Hey, Pete, thanks a lot for the call. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Sheila in Amherst. Sheila, you're on.
Hi there. I'd like to ask the chef about best ways to prepare a whole fresh ham, but it's in the freezer.
Okay. Well, first you'd want to thaw it in the refrigerator, you know, and it might take a couple of days to thaw depending on how big the ham is. And I always like to brine my hams. So it's very simple. It's a cup of salt for every gallon of water and then half a cup of sugar. And that's a basic brine recipe. And then you can flavor it however you'd like. So I usually add some garlic, some bay leaf. And then you could add rosemary, thyme, some juniper berries, whatever you want the flavor to be. You get that, let that get nice and cool, and then you submerge your ham in there. If your refrigerator isn't big enough for that, you can use a cooler and put some ice packs in there to keep it cold. Or if you live in a place where you can put it outside and it's cold enough in the winter. And the animals won't get it in a car or something.
Okay.
Yeah.
And depending on the weight of the ham, you're going to want to brine it for a fair amount of time. You don't want to over brine it, but I would say for a 10-pound ham, if you leave it in there, you know, 8 hours or so, that'll
do
it. 8 to 12 hours would be enough. You don't want to over brine it because once you brine it too much, it takes on more of a characteristic of a cured ham, and that may or may not be something you want.
And then make sure you rinse it, right?
Yeah.
I've known people who brined turkeys and forgotten to rinse, and it can be a little interesting.
The turkey, I think it's more of a problem than the ham is.
Yeah.
Usually the ham has a fat cap on the outside that water kind of runs off anyway.
Oh, okay.
And then I would roast them in the oven, so, you know, 350 until it gets to 145 in the middle.
Okay.
Thanks, Sheila.
Thank you so much.
Have a great weekend. 1-800-348-2551 on this fine food Friday. Ricky in Great Barrington. Ricky.
Hello.
You're on.
Well, I'm calling about the meat thermometer issue.
Yes.
I don't know how to use one.
That old trick. Okay.
Well,
I think when you poke it with the meat thermometer, it's letting all the juice out.
See, I'm with you. That scares me as well, Ricky. I'm glad you brought that up.
A lot of people worry about that, but there's actually a couple of different sources have tested this objectively. They've weighed the meat, they've poked it, they've reweighed it, they've poked it again, and they've reweighed it. And
you're kidding me.
No, I'm
your
not
tax
kidding.
Dollars at work. Okay,
no,
fine.
No, these are great. These are independent sources, you know, Cook's Illustrated and
okay.
Serious
right,
Eats and
enough.
Things like that.
All right, go ahead.
And they've determined that the poking it does not let all the juices leak out.
Okay.
You know, if you look at the numbers, if you look at the data, it doesn't work that way. So,
do you just poke it? If you're like you're saying about pork chops.
Yeah, so it depends on the type of thermometer that you have. The common one, which is, they call it an instant read thermometer. It has a little dial on it with, you know, an analog kind of pin.
Yeah.
If you look along the length of that thermometer, somewhere on the length is a little depression. And that's the depth you're supposed to get that thermometer in order to get an accurate reading. So for something like a pork chop, you wouldn't want to poke the tip of the thermometer into the broad side of the pork chop. You would want to poke it in kind of parallel to the broadside so that you're able to get most of that thermometer in the center of the meat.
Oh.
You know, if you poke the tip in and you're coming out on the other end, it's not going to
not
be the
work.
Right temperature yet.
Very interesting.
Ah.
Yeah, so you want to go in parallel to the broadside of the meat so that you're in the center of the meat where it's going to take the longest to cook. And you don't want to be too close to a bone because bones transfer heat more efficiently than meat does. So if you have a bone-in pork chop and you're taking the temperature right next to the bone, it's going to be artificially high.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, and then do you take it out and put the pork chop back in the pan if it's not up to snuff?
Exactly, yes.
And then stick it in again?
Yeah.
It depends
on how you can stick it in the same hole, yeah.
Oh.
Okay, well.
I'm learning a lot. Thank you. And when you cook a chicken, say, and it's in the oven, do you put the thermometer in and leave it in?
You can do that if you have what they call a probe thermometer, and instead of the probe being attached to the readout, there's a wire that connects the two. In that case, for a whole ham, a whole chicken, anything that you're doing in the oven, you can actually set those thermometers to ring an alarm when it gets to the right temperature.
Really?
Yeah.
What?
And then it's,
yeah, Rick, you
got to
get one of those. It's high tech, you know.
Oh, my gosh. And then, I got to get a chef.
Well, that would be very helpful, too.
So, yeah, if you get one of those, you can't overcook anything. It takes all the guesswork out of it.
All right.
Thanks
well, that was illuminating. Thank you, Ricky. We appreciate that question. Let's go to Mary in Columbia County. Mary, you're on with the Chef Rob Handel.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. It is a question. For my husband's birthday, I decided to take him out to a farm-to-table place. Mm. And after going there, I kind of had second thoughts about whether it was really farm-to-table, and I asked somebody who actually works there. And found out that it's kind of phony. It's really not farm to table. And I was just wondering what questions you ask or if there's a verifying group of people who can say, yes, we know that their eggs come from this place, their meat comes from that place. It seems like they made it seem like everything was farm to table, but it was actually very cake mixy and very
no names,
standardized,
please.
Like Cisco and Costco.
No names, please. All right.
Yeah, I've experienced that, too.
Oh, no, I'm not.
Okay.
I've experienced that as well. And there's no third-party source that verifies the authenticity.
There's no international farm-to-table certification?
No, not yet. I'm sure
okay.
I'm sure there one will be assembled
okay, let's
in
get
response
that done.
To this. But really, the best way is to talk to the place that you're going to, ask them a lot of questions. And sometimes that requires you to be a little educated about what is available in your area. You know, if you're going to a farm-to-table restaurant in January and they're giving you tomatoes in your salad, you know, those tomatoes aren't grown in the Capital District.
Well, could be in a hothouse, right?
They could be in a hothouse, but that's why you have to ask them, where are the tomatoes from? You know, something that people value about coming to our place is that you order in the kitchen. So it's very casual. People come into the kitchen. I'm usually the one in there, and they tell me what they'd like, and then I prepare it. So there's a lot of transparency. People see me cooking the food. They can ask me about the meat. They can ask me where I got the vegetables from. It's the best way is to talk to the place that you're going to and really ask them some questions and see how you feel about those answers.
Okay, well, thank you. And also, one last question. When you were talking about grass-fed beef, do you like grass-fed beef that's grass-fed from day one all the way to the end, or do you like grass-fed beef that's finished with grain?
No, I don't eat grass-fed beef that's finished with grain because that's really, from a health standpoint, that's the reverse way to do things. It's healthiest for the cow to be on grass, and the meat is the most nutritious when they've been on grass. So some people do grass-fed finished, which is better than 100% grain-fed, but I don't think that finishing cows on grain is as worthy as finishing them on grass.
Good question, Mary.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I mean, I guess one thing that I did notice is with grass-fed beef that I purchased, the fat is yellower
than regular. It can be, and that's from the pigments that are in the grass that they're eating. You know, yeah. that'll change from farm to farm because every farm has different vegetation.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, you know, it's best to just establish, you know, a relationship with the farm, and then you know what he's doing, and he tells you, and it's great, and it's transparent. So I was thinking of that with a restaurant. And where I live, there are plenty of restaurants like that. But we just went to this special place, and it was just so disappointing to find out that we were fooled.
Well, thank you for not saying the name.
I would never do that.
That's something that's disappointing for me and for all of us at Heather Ridge as a farm-to-table restaurant, is that things like that cast a negative light on all of us. And like I said, the best way is to communicate and to ask a lot of questions and make that decision yourself.
Chef Rob Handel is our guest. We'll take a break here. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. More good stuff on Food Friday coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from Cafe Capriccio. Chef Jim Rua, working to preserve and maintain the traditions of Italian cuisine and hospitality since 1982 on Grand Street in Albany, New York. CafeCapriccio.com. Sutter Meats, King Street, Northampton, providing fresh, local, pasture-raised beef, pork, and lamb. Additional house-made items include rotisserie chickens, bone broths, bacon jam, and handmade sausages. SutterMeats.com. Troy Savings Bank Music Hall, presenting NPR's Selected Shorts, Uncharted Territories with Sam Underwood, Patricia Callenber, and Boyd Gaines, November 13th at 8 p.m., troymusichall.org. And Oblong Books, presenting author Forrest Pritchard with his new book, Growing Tomorrow, Sunday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Rhinebeck Farmers Market, oblongbooks.com.
Welcome back to Vox Pop Food Friday, and a fun one we're having today with Chef Rob Handel of the Bee's Knees Cafe at Heather Ridge Farm in Preston Hollow. All right, the popcorn's really good, man. What is it?
So that's a maple bacon popcorn. And this is something that we make and we put out on the tables at the farm. And it's popcorn that's been popped with a little bit of bacon fat in it.
Oh, yeah.
And the maple syrup is made from our neighbors make it, and they tap our trees along the ridge and then produce this maple syrup a couple miles from the farm. And
that goes very well with the Giants game on Sunday.
It's very popular. That's one of our more popular things.
All right, let's go over to Frederick and Beekman. Frederick, you're on.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Quick question. Foraging. I've been getting more and more into foraging because of reasons that you have stated, because it's, you know, there's a lot out there. Now, on the side of the road, do I really have to worry about anything in terms of the, you know, any chemicals running off the road from the cars? The other day I was picking some, well, not the other day, last month I was picking up some grapes, and I wasn't sure if that would be okay to eat because it was right off the side of the road.
The general recommendation is that you don't pick things off the side of the road. I think that that's a decision that you should make based on how much you value
your life.
Not just your life, but you know, is it a busy road? Is it not a busy road? You know, it depends on a lot of factors. But they generally, the recommendation is to not forage on the side of the road.
Okay.
Okay, and obviously, it's somewhere in the middle of the woods would be a lot better.
Yeah, you know, you won't. It's unlikely that you would die from foraging something on the side of the road, but part of the idea with foraging is that the wild plants haven't been treated with pesticides and herbicides and fertilizers.
How can you be sure of that, by the way?
Well, it's best to know the area that you're foraging in. You know, if you know that you're in a spot where somebody
Roundup
hasn't...
Roundup is being used.
Exactly. You know, it's that's where urban foraging can become a bit of an issue because you don't know what people have been doing to things out in the middle, like you're not in the middle of a city. But if you're foraging in a place that you know is fairly untouched, that's a pretty safe place.
Okay. So with that being said, now I know obviously stuff that you will buy that's not organic, they obviously use pesticides and things you can think of. Is there really much of a difference between getting something that's not organic and getting something off the side of the road? You know what I'm trying to say?
I don't know.
Do you want to risk it?
Yeah, I think the concern is that they're different things. You know, petroleum has different properties than Roundup does, and they may both not be good for you, but I'm not qualified to make a judgment on which one is better or worse.
Gotcha. Okay. All right.
All right,
man. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and make sure you know what you're foraging. Otherwise, bad things can happen.
Bad things can happen. Yeah,
let's go to Christina in Gardner. Christina.
Hello. I was wondering where you could get duck.
Well, you could get duck at Heather Ridge Farm. Other than that, most grocery stores actually do carry duck, and it's usually in the freezer section. Yeah, so if you really want fresh duck, it's best to find a smaller butcher, find a farm that's raising duck, something of that nature. But if you really have a hankering and you're in a pinch, in the freezer section of the grocery store, they often have duck and goose.
Mm. Really, goose?
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
Any grocery store? Because I guess I haven't looked too closely.
Well,
I'm with you, Christina. I haven't seen it.
It would depend on the grocery store, of course. But I've seen it often where they have frozen turkeys out of season.
Yeah.
And sometimes there's bulk sausage and things like that. But if you look in the freezer section where there's some poultry, there's often duck.
And if you just wanted to cook, say, a duck breast, would it be troublesome? Would you have enough time to just quickly explain a quick way to do that?
Sure.
Go ahead. So when you're cooking a duck breast, the duck breast has a ton of fat in it, and that's all in the skin. So it's all in the skin. What you want to do is score it. So that means you just take a nice sharp knife and you cut that diamond pattern that you sometimes see on a restaurant duck breast.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so you just lightly cut into the skin. You don't want to cut all the way through, but you just make some shallow cuts, and you can do them in a diamond pattern. I always start it skin down. Whenever you're cooking a protein, you start cooking it on the side that you want facing up at the end.
Ah, why?
Well, when the meat is raw, it's malleable and it's flexible. So whichever side you put down first is going to settle the most on the pan, but then as it cooks, it firms up and it becomes less malleable. So you put the skin side down first, that gets you the most contact with the skin. If you were to put the skin side down second, the meat would have already started to bend, and then you would just have a small bit of it would be a concave kind of a shape.
I get it.
So I would just, score it, season it with salt and pepper. It's great to start it in a pan, skin side down, until the skin gets nice and brown and crispy. Depending on the thickness of the duck breast, you'll often then have to finish it in the oven. So the best thing is to then flip it over onto the other side. Do this in a pan that you can put into the oven, one that doesn't have a plastic handle, and then put it into an oven and cook it until it's about 120, 130, and that's a nice kind of medium-rare duck breast.
Oh, great. Perfect. Thank you so much.
Hey, Christina, thanks a lot. Have a great weekend. It's Food Friday on WAMC. 1-800-348-2551 is the number if you have a question for Chef Rob Handel. And over to Laura in Hillsdale. Laura, you're up.
Hi there. How you doing?
Good.
I have a question for Rob. I just wanted to say, I'm really inspired and impressed by what you're doing. I think it's very encouraging. I've been watching a series on Netflix called The Mind of a Chef. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, so there's a guy who was just on who was putting a lot of time and energy into raising heirloom grains.
Is that Glenn Roberts?
Yeah. And amaranth and other ones like that and varieties of corn. And it just made me curious now listening to you talk, if you have any interest at all into also trying to resurrect some of those varieties to go along with your heritage meat.
Yeah, very much so. The big stumbling block that we have is that we're up in the mountains where there's a ton of rocky soil and there's a lot of hillsides. So the reason why we only raise livestock is that our land isn't very conducive towards grain or market crops.
Sure.
I do buy quite a few products from Glenn Roberts' company. So the man you're talking about, his name is Glenn Roberts, and he has a company called Anson Mills. And so their whole mission is to resurrect these varieties of grains that are otherwise lost.
To what end?
Well, this ties back into what I was talking about with the heritage pigs, that the story with grains and with a lot of fruits and vegetables is that during the Depression, the breeding patterns changed. So whereas before the Depression, a lot of most of the breeders were breeding for flavor. So they were breeding for, you know, really great tasting grains. During and after the Depression, the focus shifted towards breeding for yield.
Yeah.
So the flavor went right out the window. So Glenn Roberts is looking to resurrect some of these grains that were otherwise lost and bring the flavor back into the
picture.
Interesting. So I support him. And there's also a place in Clinton Corners called Wild Hive. So they're in the Hudson Valley, and they produce really excellent grain locally.
Laura, thanks a lot for the call. Now, we've had people on who run orchards, and I remember talking to one who said, you know, a lot of these varieties are heritage for a reason. They're not that good, and they're susceptible to pests and things like that, and they sort of went by the wayside for very normal reasons.
Certainly for some of them that's the case, but for a lot of them, they're actually more pest resilient than the modern varieties. A lot of the modern varieties rely very heavily on pesticides. Mm. When these heirloom breed plants were around, there were no pesticides. Mm. So it was the management and it was the breeding of the plant that had to ensure the crop. Okay. So
let's go to Rob. No, I'm sorry. Bob and Oneonta. Bob, you're on.
Yes, I have a question. I just recently was in a restaurant and I ate a lamb burger from locally produced lamb, and it got served to me kind of raw in the middle and charred on the outside. And I ate it not thinking much about it because I hear about things like E. coli from beef, and I was just curious whether there was an issue.
Are you feeling okay, Bob?
Well, it was just a half hour ago.
Oh, boy. Okay. All right. Well, let us know if something happens. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, you know, the food safety guidelines, there's certain temperatures, and restaurants have to issue disclaimers if they're serving meat under those temperatures. But it really depends on the source of the meat. It is safe. There are ways to prepare beef and lamb and goat that don't require cooking. You know, you can prepare a lamb tartare that's
really
completely raw. Exactly. So it really depends on the sanitation in the kitchen and the source of the meat. I don't know the restaurant, so I couldn't comment on the safety from a specific situation.
You know, if I bit into something like that and it was dead pink in the middle, I would freak out. But Bob went for it. He just like, I'm going to eat it anyway. Good for you, Bob.
Well, is beef more readily a problem than lamb usually?
It really depends on how the animal was raised and processed. There's no way for me to know that. I can't make a general statement.
Okay, I think next time I'll go with the
commentator.
Cool. Okay.
Hey, if you live, call us next show. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks, Bob.
Bye.
See ya. Over to Mike in Fort Ann. Mike.
Good afternoon, gents. I wanted to ask Chef Handel if there was a favorite edible that he forages this time of year and how he prepares it.
This time of year. There's actually, I do a lot of mushroom foraging this time of year, which can be tricky for beginners. But otherwise, this time of year, the garlic mustard that we were talking about earlier, it's past the point where you can collect the seeds, but it's a biennial plant. It grows 2 years in a row. So the first year of growth is still out there, and they're small leaves. If you Google garlic mustard, you can learn how to identify them. And there's quite a bit of that. There's also burdock that's still available that you can dig up and use the root. And you can even find wild chives this time of year. They tend to hide in the summer because grass grows up around them. But now as the grass dies back, it's easier to find them again. So those are all things that are fairly common and not too hard to find. And, you know, the greens, you can cook them like any other greens. You can add them to soups, sautés, etc. The chives are just as versatile as commercially grown chives.
Dina Falcone's book is a real good resource.
Yeah, Dina Falcone is a great resource.
All righty. Thank you, Chef.
Thanks, Mike. We appreciate the call. It's Vox Pop. It's Food Friday, and we're in the home stretch here with Chef Rob Handel, Janice in Voorheesville. Janice.
Hi, this is Janice, and I'm calling just to give credit to this Heather Ridge Farm. We went to a pig roast there, and everything was superb.
Well, all right.
It was the best meal I've had since things I cook at home.
Are you employed by the Heather Ridge Farm at all, Janice?
Not at all.
Okay, fair enough.
Well, thank you, Janice. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, and the turkeys from there are just wonderful. I usually dissect mine because there are only two of us, and I take it all apart raw and make soup with the raw bones and cook up a thigh and leg with the stuffing underneath, and it is the most delicious turkey. I usually make little pieces of the breast meat so that I can make turkey tetrazzini or maybe Parmesan later in the year, and I freeze it. So anybody should get out there and look at their stuff and buy their stuff because it's fabulous.
Now you got me thinking about turkey croquettes. That's always one of my favorites. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Janice. I'm glad you're enjoying everything.
Thanks for the call, Janice. 1-800-348-2551. Anna in Plainfield, Mass. Hi, Anna, you're on.
Hi, I'm actually a heritage breed grass-fed farmer also.
Oh, cool.
Of swine, and I have Gloucester Old Spot pigs and Dexter cattle. And first of all, I really appreciate all the information you've been giving out because it's what we try to say too. Earlier on, I know the man was in New York, but if you're in Massachusetts, to find pastured sources, you can go on the Community and Supportive Agriculture website. I think it's Buy Food Locally or something like that. It's CISA, C-I-S-A. And with garlic mustard, if you add it to different kinds of pesto with arugula and basil and everything, it is really good also. Not necessarily the seeds, but young greens.
Yeah, the greens are great in pesto. That's a great way to use the garlic mustard.
Yeah. So anyway, thank you very much for all the information.
Well, thank you for calling.
Yeah, and we sell also from our farm. People can look up individual farms and go to farmers markets. Usually they're pastured, and very often heritage breeds at the farmers market.
Well, Anna, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. Have a good weekend. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go over to Doug in Grafton. Doug.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I just saw garlic mustard on a restricted list for plants to be grown.
Aha! That's because it's invasive, right?
Yeah. No, I'm not advocating anybody grows garlic mustard. I'm advocating people go out and get rid of the garlic mustard by eating what's there.
That would be a good idea.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Oh, yep. Thanks, Doug.
Thank you.
That was a quick and succinct call. Well done. Of course, if you cook it all, then it'll be gone forever.
Yeah. Well, it's very hard to get rid of completely.
All right. And we have just about time maybe for one more call here. So let's go over to line two and Mary in Porter Corners. Mary, you got about a minute here.
Hi. Thanks for doing the show. I raised heritage turkeys, and I let them get huge. So they had to be cut in half to fit in my oven. And I was just wondering if there's any special way to cook it. I know skin down, but would you suggest?
You're talking about cooking a half of a turkey?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, what I would do, if you're already cutting the turkey up, what I do at home is I never roast a turkey whole because it's very hard to get the breast and the leg and thigh perfect while the bird is in one piece. You know, they both have different cooking requirements. So if you're cutting it up anyway, I would really advocate that you separate the breasts from the legs and thighs and cook them separately. What I often do is I roast the breast until it's 165. That's the recommended temperature. It's nice and juicy then. And the legs and thighs, I actually braise them. So I cook them with some stock, some aromatic vegetables, nice and slow. They get really tender. And then that braising liquid makes a really fabulous gravy for the rest.
Oh, awesome. Okay, then my quick question. We also are raising pigs. How do you know how to weigh them? I know you're supposed to get them up to 230 pounds.
All right.
But how do you know that?
Well, about 10 seconds.
Yeah, that's awfully hard. We don't weigh ours. We just harvest them when we think they're ready, and we get the weights after they've been processed.
Mary, we got to run here, but thank you so much for the call, and thanks to everybody who called in today. Well, that was fun. Thanks to Chef Rob Handel of Bee's Knees Cafe at Heather Ridge Farm. What's your website?
It's www.heather-ridge-farm.com.
And if you want the recipe for, which we didn't even talk about, a delicious maple chipotle breakfast sausage, we didn't even talk about it. The show's over. Go to wamc.org/foodfriday. Support comes from Bread and Butter, newly opened restaurant in North Amherst's Mill District, offering breakfast and lunch daily, from traditional staples to chef specialties such as duck confit, hash, and maple sriracha pork belly. Bread and Butter, Amherst.com. Hawthorne Valley Waldorf School, Harlemville, New York. High school open house Saturday, November 7th from 10 to 1. Nurturing living connections, hawthornevalleyschool.org. And Subsidium Technologies, a single point of contact for area enterprises to identify telecommunications plans working to maximize information technology efficiency and employee productivity, subsidiumtech.com. That's it. Thanks for calling. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Chef Handel. Thanks to Zach Malloy at the controls. Your phones were answered by Barb King, Jessica, our producer. I'm Ray Graff. Have a wonderful weekend. Stand by for news.